Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. You may have noticed my announcement now includes my new book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. It'll be out in the end of July, but you can purchase advanced copies, including at a discount on my website, Bregan.com. We have yet another tragedy, drug-related most probably. Mary Richardson Kennedy, the estranged wife of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., was found dead in her apartment in New York City, where she lived. She had been depressed for some time. This is undoubtedly a very complicated situation. But found in her blood were trazodone, a sedative antidepressant, dexmethylvenfaxine, and venlafaxine, all three found in her blood. Now, there's been some mistakes in the media saying she must have had three antidepressants at once, because dexmethylvenlafaxine is the substance of Prestique. So they were thinking, oh my gosh, she had Prestique in her system and venlafaxine, which is Effexor. But it's a little complicated, but actually the dexmethylvenlafaxine is a breakdown product of venlafaxine. So I think she probably had Effexor and trazodone in her system. Did this cause her death? Did the antidepressants make her suicidal? Of course, I don't know in the distant position that I hold in regard to this situation. I only know it's in the news. But we're seeing so many of these cases now. It's really time for the press and for the public and the profession to get much more concerned about this. But in addition, consider that these drugs really don't work very well, if at all. Controlled clinical trials, when you look at all of them, not just a few selected by the drug companies to give to the drug to give to the FDA, controlled clinical trials don't show a significant effect of these drugs compared to placebo. Everybody who takes placebo or the drug gets a little better, or at least a significant, not everybody, of course, but a significant percentage of them. Consider also the long-term effects, more and more data now. A lot of it in my new book. The data show that people get worse and worse on psychiatric drugs, and in particular antidepressants, and often end up on disability. And consider the fact that these drugs often overstimulate people and drive them to drink, and drink more and more. Now, in Mary Kennedy's case, no alcohol was found in her system, just the evidence that she was taking trazodone and Effexor. That's that situation. Now, why are people continuing to take these drugs? We're going to find out about that from not only what you hear from me, but from my guest. But before getting to her, and it's going to be a very interesting show, consider as some evidence for how and why people keep taking these drugs the absolute hypocrisy and often criminal behavior and civil fraud of the drug companies. We now have more and more data coming out from the Justice Department on just how bad the drug companies are, confirming things I've been saying for years and things that my guest has been saying. We now have a $3 billion settlement by the Justice Department, criminal and civil, with admission of criminal charges by GlaxoSmithKline concerning Paxil, Wellbutrin, both of which are antidepressants, and Advair, the asthma drug. I've been fighting the Paxil issues for years, written about it in my books and in many other areas. It's good to see the government honing in on this. It's good to see them releasing lots of important documents. it's unfortunate to think about what a small amount of punishment $3 billion are. My last two blogs, one out just today on Huffington Post, discuss the government settlement with GSK and take a look at some of the more important findings in it. My today's blog is about an appalling video where the drug company is promoting Advair in this bizarre and I just think sinful and criminal manner, as in the worst movie caricature of this kind of behavior. So there's lots going on, and I have a very, very, very apt guest tonight. Her name is Martha Rosenberg. Martha, you there?
I'm here.
Well, Martha is the author of, glad to hear you're here, by the way. That's worth more than a side. Martha is the author of Junk Food, Born with a Deficiency, How the Flax, Quacks, and Hacks Pimp the Public Health. So, Born with a Junk Food Deficiency. I love it. It's a good book. Martha, hello.
Well, and, hi there, Dr. Brennan.
You want to just jump in this? Maybe even talk about the direct-to-consumer advertising that you know so much about.
Well, thank you. First, I'd really like to reiterate what you said about Kennedy, because as we know, Prestique was marketed when Effexor ran out of patent, and it was just a metabolite, so it was a money-making scheme. And then you referred to an Advair ad, and a lot of what I talk about in my first book chapters are these ads that are often unconscionable and really market below the belt.
I wasn't talking about ads, but I want you to talk about ads.
Okay.
I'm referring to I wasn't very clear. I think I'm a little garbled today, handling so many topics, and really glad to have you on. I was talking about the coming out party for Advair, the launch, it's called, that was held by the drug company with the executives prancing around on the stage like rock stars, exhorting the thousands of salespersons amid applaud to make $1 million each on selling Advair. It was really disgraceful. And using God and country, which just appalled me. And you can get that. You can go today to Huffington Post and plug in Bregan, and you'll find this latest blog. And now I'm going to sit back and let you talk a bit, Martha Rosenberg.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. You know, my next book, not this one, Born with a Junk Food Deficiency, but the next one is really does get into these asthma drugs. And I don't think I'll talk about it too much now because I'm still researching it, but Advair and the long-acting beta agonists have been really correlated with a lot of deaths, and many physicians have called for their withdrawal. And they're so on top of making obscene amounts of money on mongering some of these drugs, the drug itself, the Advair Singular Acrylate and Symbicort, are highly correlated with negative outcomes that are worse than the asthma itself. So I talk about that more in my next book. But the direct-to-consumer advertising itself, which leads off this current book, was pretty much begun in the late 90s, 1997 or so. The first ad that actually ran on TV was for Claritins. And, you know, probably 5 years later, everyone and his brother had seasonal allergies. So I believe that the direct-to-consumer advertising has created a lot of hypochondria, a lot of suggested diseases that people didn't have before and didn't know existed before, and now self-diagnose and go to their physicians and say, and they self-prescribe. Some of the examples of obviously depression and bipolar, but also insomnia, also GERD, the gastro-reflux diseases. And even now we're seeing, on top of the insomnia that everyone is supposed to have, wakefulness medications, which, you know, are basically, stimulants. And there's a real sick yin and yang going on between the insomnia and the wakefulness needs that people have. You know, they're taking the, you know, both sides of the mushroom.
Well, tell us some more about how all this got started and what you think the implications are, because I think the issue of direct-to-consumer advertising is a very interesting one and a somewhat tough one, because I think it does involve the issues of freedom of speech and freedom of advertising, and yet it's doing a lot of damage. So let me just get more of your opinions about this.
Well, I have to say that before working as a reporter and a journalist, I was in advertising. And so I'm very hard on it because I know it works. And I always tell an anecdote about when I was in an ad agency, I saw an ad for a car that I thought was a good ad, and I put it on my wall. And I never thought I even looked at the car. I just liked the composition of the ad. But about a year after I put it on my wall, I bought that exact car. So I believe advertising works subliminally, and we know it works. Few people are, a lot of the media are not going to attack the drug ads because they're almost the major ads right now, you know, for television, radio, magazines, newspapers, and they're so lucrative to media. That, and not to mention, you know, public relations and the agencies that make the ads. So it's most people really like them. They're either entertaining to people or they're making money for many different parties. But I'm against them because I always say the direct-to-consumer advertising reduces a doctor to a gatekeeper and an order taker. And it makes a sham of medical school training. And it created a lot of hypochondria. So, you know, I'm against it, and I think that it will never go away. I think it's here to stay.
I remember when I was a kid, Martha, penicillin had just come out, and I got a cold, and my mother took us to our family doc, whom I remember as a really kind and gentle human being. And said to him, my son needs penicillin, and he said, no, Mrs. Bragan, he has a cold. I'm not going to give him penicillin for that. He'll get over the cold, and the penicillin, you know, is just going to add new problems. And she just whisked me off and brought me to a new doctor, and I don't think I ever saw my kind and gentle one again. And the fact that when she took me to, it was hardly kind and gentle.
That's horrible. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yep. It puts a lot of pressure on the docs, too.
Well, it's terrible, but on top of really degrading a medical professional by telling him or her what you have and what you need, it also subliminally sells that medical professional, him or herself also. And that's the part that why advertising is so insidious, because it is subliminal. So, you know, you would think we had a big epidemic of GERD and insomnia and seasonal allergies, you know, when it's just that's where money could be made. And so people, I think, when they hear these ads and the PSAs, which are often pharma disguised as PSAs, they think that these are actually messages from the Centers for Disease Control or the government, and they don't even realize it's for profit. One thing I talk about in my book, Born with a Junk Food Deficiency, are different types of ads and how canny and foxy they can be. And one example, the pills are sold just like beer because the same principles of advertising work. And the principles of advertising include positioning, you know, as far as you're the best in the field or the cheapest, and repetition and also benefit. And so years ago there was a humorous thing about can your beer do this? And that type of ad literally came back to sell Wellbutrin. And there was an ad in, I think, People or some magazine that literally said, can your medication do this? And the claim they were making was that it didn't have the sexual side effects of the SSRIs. But it was literally a beer ad. And then also, I not too long ago saw an ad for a sleeping pill, Lunesta, and the headline of the ad was, Lunesta Sleep, Have You Tried It? Well, that is very similar to the Kodak moment, the Malax moment, the L&M moment, you know, which would be back in the 60s. So, you know, you're creating a designer pill, kind of. And so the advertising is extremely nuanced and sophisticated and subtle, and it really works.
What do you think are the effects of all the warnings that our FDA required and sometimes make it onto the television? What do you make about on the effects of this litany of stuff that is appearing on the TV?
Well, first of all, we know that warnings, even graphic and scary ones, don't work as far as cigarettes. So I think that when there's enough incentives, they can easily be ignored. But there's also a school of thought that says that the roster of risks, you know, whether say hemorrhaging, death, shortness of breath, you know, that they actually, for some perverse reason, sell the drug either as a dare or just because it's kind of exciting to think of all these things that can happen. Years ago, there used to be a book, I think it was in the 60s, called The Hidden Persuaders, by Vance Packard, and his theory was that death sold. And I don't know if it was a proven theory, but it was his theory. And he showed skulls that were hidden in bottles of alcohol. You know, they were selling some kind of nice whiskey, and inside would be the skull. And so there is a theory. Certainly we know that the risks do not unsell the drug. We even kind of know that the black boxes don't sell it, maybe because there's so much of it that people don't see it anymore. But the risk data, I don't believe, discourages the docs from prescribing or the patients from requesting. A lot of people spoof it and find it entertaining, and I don't think they realize it's true. And, you know, one example, one class of drugs that I'm watching a lot are the stimulants like the Provigil and Nuvigil, which are, those two in particular, very correlated with, you know, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, you know, the very life-threatening skin reactions. And when you hear that ad, I would say maybe four-fifths of the ad are those dangers. They also talk about suicidal ideation and hallucinations, but mostly the skin stuff. And you have to just wonder, why would an ad that has all this, these warnings still sell product? And of course it's selling product or they wouldn't run it. And I think it's just maybe a perverse twist of human nature.
This is very, very interesting. One thing that occurs to me is the old bitter snake oil phenomena, mm-hmm. which is if something's horribly bad tasting, it must be good for you. I mean, I can remember years and years ago getting a tummy ache from maybe as a very young man or boy, getting a tummy ache from antibiotics and thinking, boy, if it's doing that to my tummy, imagine what it's doing to the bugs. So I think a part of it may be that, this is really powerful stuff, man, really powerful stuff. I think it's very complicated and hard to understand. Certainly the doctors, I can tell you with certainty, tend to play down these ads. I mean, I know doctors, and I learned this through my work as a medical expert in lawsuits.
Right, right.
You know, like particularly malpractice suits. And the doctors will tell patients, the drug companies, they have to put that there, but it doesn't mean anything. Or they might even say, the drug companies cover themselves by putting it there, so then you can't sue them for it because they put it there. Actually, the drug companies fight against putting this stuff in their labels unless all the drugs in the group are going to get it. They don't want to be singled out with any of these labels.
Oh, you're absolutely right, yes. They'll have the wording, like all antibiotics, this antibiotic causes X, Y, and Z. You know, some of the antibiotics now are highly correlated with C. difficile bacterium, you know, which is now...
C. diff.
Pardon me?
Yeah, C. diff, sure.
And, you know, again, I'm sure people will say, well, ignore it. They just legally have to put that in there. But in point of fact, people are having fecal transplants. I mean, it's an actual problem in nursing homes and hospitals, these C. diffs. And so ignore it at your own peril. I think very few people look at a warning and say, I won't take this pill, because they're thinking, well, the doctor wouldn't have given it to me if it weren't safe. And, of course, he's thinking, or she, it wouldn't have been approved if it weren't safe. And what I'm seeing a lot is that many drugs that once wouldn't have been approved are now, because they've passed the risk on to patients. And one of the best examples, I think, are the bisphosphonates. That would be Boniva and Actonol and Fosamix. And about 6 months after they were approved, and some say Merck already knew this, but FDA didn't know this, there was maybe 2,000 reports of esophageal irritation. There were even patients who were hospitalized, you know, with the throat, the irritation from taking these bisphosphonates. And so rather than saying, where the heck were these data, and some in FDA actually wanted to unapprove it, instead FDA let Merck add on to the Fosamix that patient has to sit up for 60 minutes after taking pill and drink no water and no juice or anything, putting the risk on the patient. Now, there was a day that a drug like that would not be approved.
That is a really, really interesting point. And this is the calcium bone density drugs, right?
Right, the anti-osteoporosis drugs, right.
Yeah. Boy, this is all very interesting. I got a lot of thoughts spinning around in my head about why people don't want to face these things. I mm-hmm. think one of the issues is, it won't happen to me. I mean, that's mm-hmm. a really yeah. common feeling. It won't happen to me, or it only happens to some people, and... I noticed this at times when we've had legal cases where you'd think the jury would really believe that a patient had been injured by a drug. And at times, you know, sometimes we win, but sometimes it's as if the juries just don't want to believe that a drug made somebody suicidal or made somebody violent. And I can remember back in my early days, after I became a psychiatrist, I still believed that no drug could make you do anything you didn't want to do. And I certainly learned when I began to research it that drugs were making millions of people do things they never would have done, that it actually showed up in controlled clinical trials, that give people a sugar pill 100 and give people Prozac 100, and, several people on the Prozac are going to get really crazy. And not on the placebo. So clearly the drugs can make you do and regularly make you do things you don't want to do. And I think that's a related phenomena that, won't happen to me,
exactly.
Or, I'll be stronger than that. Or,
well, you know, I've attended many FDA hearings, advisory committee hearings, and I've heard just outrageous risks from the pharma doctors. And what always seems to happen is... The FDA officials will say, "Well, we'll put that on the label. We'll put that on the warning." Never have I heard, "Well, we won't approve it." You know, so
that's
what,
right.
It's almost like, "Well, we could this." They'll say a new treatment option is by definition positive, but really, with some of these conditions, we have enough treatment options. So it really is just capitalism.
Well, capitalism, greed, human nature, all those things. Yes, it has to do with money. It has to do with money.
That's what it is. And I've not heard any, there's so many drugs that, let's say, the last 10 years have just been withdrawn, like Meridia, the diet pill, and obviously Vioxx. And nobody really asks, well, why were we taking this for so long, and why did the... side effects only emerge after the public and the answer is because we rushed it to market, because we're so psychologically enmeshed with big pharma that we want it to get out there as much as they do. You're right. People think, well, this wouldn't happen to me, or it's really safe. And then another beef that I've often talked about is, and you must see this yourself, Dr. Bregan, when patients are harmed, what so often happens is they will get a settlement that will include a gag order. So what really happened to them and could happen to you does not get out into the press.
Yeah, I had one of the early Paxil suits where a man, after two doses of Paxil, given probably for some nervousness and tension quitting smoking, killed himself and his two children, drowned all three of themselves in a tub, the Lac Cousin case. And I got inside the company. I found out that indeed serious adverse effects were occurring in day one and day two of taking the drugs, which doctors don't realize. I found out the company was hiding its suicides under false names, that it was making the suicides look less by making believe that some also occurred in the placebo group when they didn't, and just on and on and on. And I couldn't publish a word of it. But then in another case I was involved in after the Lac Cousin case, a challenge was made to the judge saying, you know, don't let Dr. Breggin testify. Look at, he doesn't have any information at all. Whereupon the lawyer, Don Faber, who was the same lawyer in Lac Cousin, said, oh, Your Honor, we have all this. Here's the Lac Cousin case. And it slipped into the courtroom, my whole huge report, and then became public. So I was able to write three scientific articles about all of this.
When it normally doesn't reach the public.
Never reaches. But even then, the media ignored it. The media didn't want to deal with the companies being that evil. And it's a great satisfaction to me to see the federal government, the Department of Justice, confirming what I've been saying, that GlaxoSmithKline was evil, that is, committed civil and criminal offenses in the way it developed and marketed Paxil. But, God, it comes late, and it comes with so little ultimate effect.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the sad fact about so many of these pills is that even if they're withdrawn or highly restricted, and even if $3 billion are assessed against the pharma company, they have still made a profit. And like you said, their stock is going to go up. So where is the punishment?
I think it's non-existent to a great extent. It's very, very sad. In fact, they had already put away at least the $3 billion, and their stock literally went up because people were reassured it wasn't any bigger than $3 billion. So, I mean, that's how little effect it had. This is a drug that was making, a lot more than double $3 billion a year and projected to do so for a long time. Talking about Advair, but also Paxil was making billions and Wellbutrin was making billions. So the $3 billion that they were charged was so small compared to these three drugs making independently billions and billions every year.
Well, you're absolutely right. And there's some people say that the CEOs and COOs need to be incarcerated, and also we need to get them out of the entitlement programs, because as long as they've got their hands in, the VA and DOD pharmacy and the Medicaid and Medicare, there's no punishment, because that's so much of the revenue stream is our tax dollars. So really, a lot of these settlements are a joke, because nothing has really changed. And you've talked about the drowning of these children, and the press doesn't report this. I'm sure you and your listeners are aware of the SSRI Stories website.
Sure, but it's good to mention it.
Yeah, and I knew the lady who conceptualized it and ran it, and she recently passed away, but she was a good friend of mine. And at that point, let's say maybe 6 months ago or a year ago, there was almost 5,000 news stories. And these aren't, opinions or blogs. They're, normal daily newspapers. That the point of the report was usually an obituary or a crime report. And it would say at the scene was found, a bottle of Cymbalta or something. And in almost 5,000 of these stories included bizarre violence, homicide, suicide, and bizarre behavior correlated with SSRI intake, not even the other psychoactive drugs, just the SSRIs. And I walked through that site once. I spent maybe a week just walking through the stories, and I found a huge amount of parents and even grandparents drowning their kids in the bathtub.
Bizarre,
I could be wrong, but I just don't believe that happened until the SSRIs.
I certainly didn't hear of cases of it. Listen, we're going to go to break. We're talking with Martha Rosenberg. Her book is Born with a Junk Food Deficiency. When we come back, we might talk about another way the drug companies are making money, which is shoving it down the throats of our military, and other tragic stories, and maybe some glimmers of hope if we can find some. Thanks for continuing to listen in the second half hour. It doesn't look like we're quite going to break yet.
Oh, okay. We're
I'm
still
waiting
on?
For my music to come in.
Oh, okay.
There it goes. Thanks, guys.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
This is Dr. Peter Bragan, and my guest is Martha Rosenberg, Born with a Junk Food Deficiency. It has a great subtitle, How Flax, Quacks, and Hacks Pimp the Public Health. And it's got a bright red cover you can't miss, and lots of pictures, and I think she's a cartoonist. Yeah, I remember she is, actually. And there's lots of cartoons in the book. And it covers a multitude of pharma sins from across the board. Some of the titles are Go On and Be Happy, Antipsychotics for Everyone, Molecules That Keep on Giving, Help, My One-Year-Old Has GERD. Boy, are there tragedies behind that, and the use of antipsychotic drugs like Reglan to giving to these one-year-olds and younger. And broader than psychiatry, where places I don't usually go on the show, weapons of hormonal therapy, we could talk about some of that today, and the war after the war. And that's about the drugging of our soldiers, and that's just a tiny beginning of one interesting chapter after another, expanding way beyond psychiatry, and yet with all this breadth of coverage and knowledge, she maintains a very good and accurate view of one subspecialty of psychiatry. So I really appreciate what you're doing, Martha Rosenberg. How can folks get you, find you?
Oh, okay. Well, and thank you for mentioning all the details about my book. Actually, my blog, or when I first post an article, is opednews.com. So if they go to opednews.com/Martha, that's kind of my site. And that's where I have my cartoons and my reporting. So that's the best place to go. Now, for getting back to the books for a second, in addition to talking about these drugs, the psychiatric drugs, I also discuss a lot of the big pharma in the food we eat. I know there's been a lot of coverage of genetic engineering, but there hasn't been as much coverage as there should be of the veterinary drugs that are in, the poultry and the beef. And so that's another thing that I urge people who care about what they're eating to read it for that.
Well, go ahead and talk about some of your interests in general. I think it might be refreshing to step a little outside psychiatry on my show. So talk about some of your other interests in more depth.
Well, I would call most of my interest as far as a reporter, and certainly this book, would come under the heading of consumer, consumer rights. And that has kind of fallen into a lot of interest groups where, you know, people are environmentalists or they're food activists or they're animal rights activists. But there is a larger, something binds them all together, which is really that the 99% of us are consuming products, either drugs or food, that are not as safe as we think, And often the things that are being hidden from us have to do with profits, you know, that it's cheaper to not, let's say one example might be, let's not label milk made with bovine growth hormone because fewer people will buy it, so we don't label it, but, well, what is it doing to our kids and, you know, that type of thing. So most of the issues I write about have to do with, I would call them really corporate criminals.
I think so, yes.
If it's not too strong a term, you know, so...
I've been dealing with those folks for a long, long time. Yeah, there's criminals everywhere, and in corporations they can have a lot of power and they can do a lot of harm.
Yeah, and now all we really have is a free press and consumer indignation and experts like yourself. You know, we're up against a lot of money. You know, and that's how it's. I'm sure you're aware of these interest groups that are created, the AstroTurf consumer fund groups that pharma creates to make a pill look like it's needed when it's not. You know, people, there's so much of this public opinion that is bought by big pharma.
Well, the way they push drugs on kids, one of their main methods was through CHAD, and still is, and CHAD is supposed to be children and now children and adults with attention deficit disorder, but CHAD was a front group for the pharmaceutical industry. I think I was the first one to blow the whistle on that way back in toxic psychiatry. But that kind of thing happens all the time. I mean, the Mental Health Association gets funds from this. All these bipolar mm-hmm. groups you hear about, mm-hmm. they're all getting funding from the pharmaceutical industry, at least
of
them.
Dr. Brennan, that might be a very good segue into the military chapter in my book, because I discovered when I was researching it that at least two, and I'm going to say at least four top military officials, doctors, are pharma consultants, which, first of all, I don't even know how that could happen. I mean, that feels to me like an abuse of our rights, you know, our government rights to have someone in power over citizens to be a pharma consultant. But that has been a big reason why our Army and our, you know, other or armed forces are so medicated.
Martha, that's really important. I didn't know that. You know, I don't often get startled in my own area, but mm-hmm. I knew that these guys at the top of the Army had to have some connection, because they're just spreading the drugs like, you know, throwing mm-hmm. seeds into the wind to cover the ground. And I didn't know that the data was there. You got that data.
You name names
in your book?
I do name the names in my book. And what I'll just say on the air here is that the executive director of the National Center for PTSD is an AstraZeneca consultant by his own admission. And also the head of PTSD at Ralph Johnson VA Hospital or VA Center. And those are just some of the high-level decision-makers who literally were accepting money from Big Pharma to conduct trials to help their pill sell, and publishing government pieces and treatment guidelines, pushing that drug that they're paid for by Big Pharma to push. And, you know, that is one of my favorite disclosures in my book, because I have not seen the press ask, why is this permitted? I mean, this is not even hidden.
And I haven't seen these answers before. So listen, I'd like you to invite you to do a newsletter for our Empathic Therapy Center. It goes out to about 3,000 people mm-hmm. to do a newsletter, maybe a piece, maybe 1,000 words or a little less, a little more in that range, on this subject of the connections between the military and the drug companies, this whole PTSD, and maybe also you can figure out something with the TBI, the head injury people.
Right.
Go ahead. Would you do that for me? Promise on the air. No, you don't have to promise on the air. But I'd like you to do that and send it to me and to Ginger, because this is really important. Mm-hmm. And it would, you know, give you a chance. You can publish it anywhere else you want.
I would be delighted to do that. This information is so important, because I think many of us assume that there's kind of a conflict of interest rule in there that would prevent this kind of shameless marketing, using the government to push pharma's agenda. And there isn't any attempt that I've seen to get rid of high-level conflicts of interest. So, yes, I would love to do that. And what I found, you know, the troops are given all kinds of psychoactive drugs, as you know, and many of these uses that the military psychiatrists have kind of concluded that would be useful, you know, as far as an atypical antipsychotic or an SSRI, are from journal articles that these government officials who are working for pharma have planted. So, you know, it leads, it's not innocent because it leads to the guidelines, the treatment guidelines and the, what they would call the best practices. And, you know, it's not even hidden, as I say, in the military.
Yeah, that practice was one of the things that the government, the Department of Justice, pointed out in regard to Paxil, where the drug
yes.
company took a study that failed, that they couldn't use, mm-hmm. to show that Paxil had helped children. They literally didn't work, but they found a way of tweaking it and making believe. And then they wrote an article and got a dozen or more famous psychiatric drug advocates to sign on to it and published it in a prestigious journal mm-hmm. as an article supporting giving Paxil for depression in children and adolescents. Mm-hmm. Literally an article on, based on research that failed to prove the point.
I remember reading about that. And also, of course, Paxil was or I'm sure is, big in the military formularies, too. But you're right. It's you know, they float the use. And, you know, the CMEs, of course, are so corrupt. And, you know, so I see some of these bigwigs over at the VA, you know, float. They have floated the use of Seroquel as a sleep med. Well, it's not approved as a sleep med, but the military actually put into its guidelines use this as a sleep med because these pharma pushers, you know, are opinion leaders and they're abusing their rights as officials by trying to make more money, you know, trying to sell these drugs, and it's effective and it works. And, you know, we could talk a little bit about Seroquel because I do have a lot of my military chapter centers on Seroquel, which I'm sure you know is a atypical antipsychotic similar to Zyprexa and Risperdal and Abilify, I think, and Geodon. And some families that I have gotten to know over the years, so military families in West Virginia, had at least four and probably more had their young men die in their sleep while they were on Seroquel and some other drugs in these cocktails they give them. And so I began really looking at what is going on here, you know, with the whole PTSD treatment is just criminal. The huge cocktails of antidepressants and antipsychotics and pain meds and, you know, now they're really big on giving epileptic drugs or seizure drugs as pain meds. So these cocktails could probably in and of themselves kill somebody because they're not tested, the drugs aren't tested together. But these families said they really felt that these were sudden cardiac arrests in the young men's sleep. And so they began talking to what is the name of that lady there, Woodcock, over there at FDA?
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
You know, they said, we really believe there's a cardiac property going on here that caused the death of our loved ones. And she wrote back, I don't know, maybe a year later or maybe less, you're absolutely wrong. It's completely safe. It doesn't interact with methadones and other drugs. And just a short time after she did that, FDA reversed its whole thing and it said, yes, it does cause cardiac.
That's right.
Right. That was last summer. And so literally reversed and said these families were right and FDA was wrong. And, you know, so like why was this drug given so widely? Why is it still given so widely? Why were these families not heard? And obviously, why did these young men have to die?
Yes, and the drug, as you point out, is given in cocktails
mm-hmm.
and with other drugs that can cause cardiac arrhythmias, like Paxil. Paxil is a common offender mixed with the Seroquel.
Mm-hmm.
Stimulant drugs given to keep them awake because they're being so sedated. can also contribute to the cardiac arrhythmias and sudden death. And these are young men with no other disorders. So these are very, very real problems. And, of course, as you know, these soldiers can be given 180 days of Seroquel when they go into combat. So here you're a soldier and you're lugging with you maybe 180 days of addictive Xanax, 180 days of addictive other drugs, 180 days of a drug that can kill you, Seroquel, that's being given to you even off-label for sleep. And then, of course, you're a young person. You're 18, you're 19, you're 20 years old. You got your buddies, and what do? You know, you figure if you trade this for that and trade here one, play a little cards for them. And besides, since you don't really like taking them, you don't take them very often. But then you have some really bad stress. You take three or four or five times the dose because that ought to be good for really bad stress. These are unsupervised young men and women.
Yeah.
Who at best have a corporal or a sergeant who they can talk to about things, but they're rarely going to get to a medical officer or healthcare person.
You're absolutely right. And I've read in one report that this group that went to Iraqi freedom and Afghanistan was the first group of young people who had really grown up on psychoactive drugs, because many of them, not obviously all of them, had been diagnosed with ADHD, and so this was kind of the first generation to grow up already on drugs, who were already sending people out into battle on a daily, you know, drug. And so this, there was a time when your troops would not be on anything. You wouldn't have them on medicines out there in the battlefield. And like you say, there's no supervision. You know, I heard horror stories when I began researching these cocktails of people that, well, one in particular in my book, where this young man was, he was out at the 20 Palms out in California, and he was so drugged up, and of course the memory also, when you're that drugged up, you don't remember, did you take this one or not, you know, did I take this drug, nobody's supervising it. His mom called and asked him, please check on him because he's all alone in the barracks and his memory isn't even there, you know. And 2 days later they checked on him and he was gone. He had died. So, you know, these drug cocktails, in my opinion, as a reporter, are probably doing more harm than some of the actual combat that's occurred for these young people.
Well, that's actually now a statistical fact that as of this year, more soldiers died from suicide than in combat. Never happened before. So that has actually now happened. And the it's a really bizarre situation because, as you alluded to, before the Iraqi war, soldiers never went into combat on psychiatric drugs. Now I get calls from soldiers who want me to help them not be forced to take drugs in order to go into combat because they want to go into combat drug-free. They want to be deployed. Mm-hmm. They want to get there. They want to do their service and do their duty to country. Mm-hmm. And they're literally being told by psychiatrists, you can't go unless you take these drugs. It's a bizarre situation.
The military has become so medicated. I don't know why there have been some good reports, including New York Times and Denver Post, but not as much as you would think, considering what a big issue it is. It is a completely medicated army. The statistics are unbelievable. I think that I read that last year there were 50,000 prescriptions for Seroquel, even after its heart effects were advertised. You know, and so there's a whole new way of managing. And they, you know, as you know, a TBI, a traumatic brain injury, is also going to affect the way those drugs are, you know, metabolized in the person because of the blood-brain barrier. And so we don't even know how these drugs are going to affect these poor souls, you know, who are just given. I saw when I was researching the book in West Virginia, shoeboxes of drugs that some of these parents showed me that their loved ones had been taking, and they would say that these drugs would arrive in the mail. Nobody asked for them. Nobody prescribed them. Nobody was overseeing. You know, how does this even happen, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I can mention this much. I mean, I'm involved in a case of a murder with a young man who's on psychiatric drugs in the service, and I've been actually involved one way or another in a few of these cases. And it's practically impossible to even find the medical records at any step of the way, any place at all. Who gave the drug, who then gave more of the drug, how this particular drug got started. You can't even find the medical records. That's how unsupervised and cavalier this whole process is. I think, Martha, that your research on the connections between the top dogs in psychiatry, or whoever they are, in the military and the VA, who are pushing this, and their connections to the drug companies is extremely important.
You've got to follow the money. That's the whole thing. And one lady who's a top leader in the military appeared in a video funded by pharma. You know, which there was a time when a government official wouldn't appear in a pharma-funded, you know. And they asked her, what about all these suicides going on? And this lady, who her name is in my book, literally said, well, that's because they get so many Dear John letters and also because they have firearms close. Nothing about the fact that legions of these people are on SSRIs, which make you kill yourself.
Do you have this video? I mean, is there a URL for it that we can get to it?
Yes, I believe that they took the video down after I wrote about it, but the information of where it was, and it was connected with the hospital, and it's in my footnotes, yes.
Wow, it's amazing. You're doing wonderful work. How did you get involved in this work? You're a journalist. How did you get to be an expert in psychiatric drugs and marketing and all that stuff?
Well, I think probably just like you, I'm very, very motivated by anger. You know, how could this be going on? You know?
Yes. How has it affected your career as a journalist to be writing in this area? It can be pretty deadly for the career, as I understand it.
Well, you know, I'm grateful to the shows like this that let us talk about this, and I'm very grateful to my publisher for letting me get these facts out. I really have not had career problems as far as people who would censor this, but I have had probably five or more love letters from Big Pharma, you know, humbly asking me to shut up. You know, I mean, certainly you get threatened, you know, but I think that if you do your homework, as you clearly do too, as in these court cases, if you can actually prove what you're saying, well, then it's not slander or defamation or any of that, because it's just true, you know.
Well, that's right. But nonetheless, it's dealing with any being sued by any of these companies is a bit like invading Russia. It's not right or wrong. You don't want to do it. But I'm willing. I'm willing to do whatever it takes, and they know that. I think they've learned that now, that Peter Bregan's willing to do what it takes. And besides, he's not alone. He has Ginger Bregan, and he's got legions of angels and a tremendous support network, which is only scratched in the 50 or more advisory council members to the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy.
You've done wonderful things, yes.
You really are doing wonderful work. And again, the book, I'll read it to you one more time, and then we'll finish up. The book is Born with a Junk Food Deficiency, How Flax, Quacks, and Hacks Pimp the Public Health by Martha Rosenberg. And let me just finish up thanking Martha with all my heart for doing the work you're doing and for coming on to the show. Maybe we'll do a follow-up later on the military issues. I hope very much you'll write about it. And folks, take a look at my latest blog on Huffington Post. We really do have a treasure trove of information now coming out of the federal government. Interestingly enough, I had a lot of this information myself, but couldn't make it public because of settled cases. But now it's coming out. So go to Huffington Post, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.